ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
About 1 billion people are currently casting their votes in India.
And it looks very much like they're overwhelmingly voting for one man, Narendra Modi.
Yes, we talk about India as being the world's biggest democracy, but is that still true? Could the biggest democratic exercise in history elect an autocrat?
It's Modi's world, Jerry. We're all just living in it. I'm Hamish McDonald.
And I'm Geraldine Duke. Welcome to Global Roaming.
Big story, very big election, very big population as well, Geraldine. India going to the polls.
Yes, we may have taken it for granted, but it really is one of those, I think, pivotal elections where a lot is being decided, far more than just the numbers of votes. It is actually quite a, it's a well-run election. It's huge, but there's nobody suggesting that there are boxes being tampered with. Like it is, they've got a process. I don't think it's quite the AEC, but gee, it's not bad. Now, there are other aspects of it that we're certainly are very worrying, but that part of it is right,
I think. It takes place over a series of weeks, 5 or 6 weeks. We will start to get the results over that time. But obviously, Narendra Modi expected to be returned for a third term in office. And I guess what's striking is that he's radically reshaped Indian politics during that time. And if he is re-elected, as the polls strongly suggest he will be, it will affirm the direction that he is taking India in. And I think that's what we're going to get into today, because Australia and other countries like the United States are betting pretty big on India as a counterweight to China. And so there are big geopolitical implications.
Yes, there certainly are. And our whole relationship with them has gone beyond the old sort of curry and cricket, which didn't work, curry, cricket, Commonwealth, the three C's. And it seems to have moved definitely beyond that. But the question will be, if this place called India, this remarkable mixture of cultures, actually goes in the way it looks like it's going at the moment, which is not exactly democratic, what will we do about that? I mean, there are some very disturbing things there in terms of a lot of hate speech, things that really make your teeth rattle sort of thing. And yeah. I think we're very much in a work in progress.
And of course, I think we were all taken by surprise this week with the news that that nest of spies that Australia had kind of alluded to in recent years actually was a nest of Indian spies.
Extraordinary.
Really quite extraordinary.
I thought it was Russian, to be honest, possibly Chinese, but I never, ever picked the Indians.
So we're going to do something slightly different in this episode. We're going to talk to two guests. In a moment, we'll speak to someone who's been thinking deeply about how India is shifting under Modi. This person was raised in Kolkata, but since straddled two worlds, India and the West. And in fact, he's one of those journalists that has actually met and spoken to Modi. So a lot to tap into there. But first, we're going to introduce you to Avani Dias. She was, until very recently, the ABC's correspondent in Delhi. But for very complicated reasons, she's arrived home. And you may have seen her face and story in places like the New York Times, the BBC. It's been quite a big deal. So here she is.
Now, Avani Dias, welcome. There's a huge election underway in India, which is the focus of our program today. You'd think you'd be there. Instead, you're back here. Why?
Yeah, it's been a pretty weird couple of weeks, to be honest. I mean, 2.5 years ago, I moved over to India to be the ABC's South Asia correspondent. And I knew when I moved over that there were some criticisms about democracy in Narendra Modi's India. I knew that there were issues around the press and freedom of the press. But honestly, I didn't think I'd get to the stage where I couldn't cover the Indian election, which was a big story that everyone wants to cover on the ground. And it all really escalated about a month ago. I got a call from a ministry official from India's equivalent of the foreign ministry. And I was told that, quote, my reporting had crossed a line and that my visa would not be extended. So every year as journalists in India, we have to get a 1-year visa extension. We apply for that. It's a pretty regular administrational process. And I was pretty shocked to get this call and be told that my actual reporting meant that I wouldn't be getting this visa.
Was there a particular report?
So earlier in the year, I went to Punjab in the north of India, where there is an active Sikh separatist movement. So a movement for that state to become a Sikh nation. And it's got pockets of supporters in places like Australia, the UK and Canada. And last year, an extraordinary allegation was made by Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, who came out and accused Indian agents of being involved in the assassination of a separatist in Vancouver. It was a major international story. Everyone was covering it, so it was obvious for us to go to Punjab, meet these separatists, meet the family of this man who was allegedly assassinated. We looked at what was happening in Australia, and during that shoot, you can see it in our story, we were intimidated by intelligence officers. We were followed around the whole time. We were stopped from shooting a public event, which was very bizarre. And then when that story came out in March, it was a few days later blocked by the Indian government on YouTube. It was called a national security threat. And the Indian government says that this movement, that they're terrorists, that they're a threat to national safety of Indians. So they said that this was a safety issue. They took down our story off Facebook as well and Instagram and so on. And the next day I received this call. I was also told in the call that my podcast, which had come out, Looking for Modi, which digs into Modi's backstory, had also been on the radar of those officials.
So, and in that final episode of that podcast series, which I really enjoyed, you do question whether India remains a democracy at all. Now, I mean, there's an election underway, so clearly there's some elements of it. But, I mean, what were you getting at?
So, it is such an interesting thing to think about because on one hand, there are these issues which the press are facing. It's not just me as a correspondent that's faced these issues. There are previous correspondents who faced visa issues. Indian journalists have it a lot worse. There are some that are jailed. Reporters Without Borders has now ranked India 161st out of 180 countries when it comes to press freedoms, a key pillar of democracy. We are seeing opposition leaders jailed. Mm. The main opposition party, Congress, has had its finances frozen for tax purposes. And so this is something that we've seen. We've seen a trend of that. But then on the other side, it's amazing to see the level of voting that is taking place in India on the ground. Just before I left, which was ironically the first day of voting in the Indian election, there were 15 million electoral staff putting out that vote on the ground. There were electric polling booths put out across the Himalayas in isolated forests in Gujarat. They find every person that wants to
really,
vote.
Isn't it?
It really is.
But when a country like China bars journalists or throws an Australian journalist out, that's seen as a really big marker point that this is a country that may be difficult for us to do business with. Yet for Australia and India, there seems to be this rush to embrace that India might be a big hope for sort of future relations. Does this ring a warning bell for us, do you think?
So it's been fascinating through my time as the correspondent watching that relationship grow between India and Australia as countries like Australia pivot away from China and try to find a friendly neighbour in the region. And they say we're one big democratic, happy family. But then there have been these criticisms, not just about the press, but all those other issues that I've listed. And of course, the main criticism of Modi's party is his Hindu nationalist politics. What critics say is his treatment of minorities, especially the Muslims. And we've seen him making comments during his campaign rallies in the last week deemed hate speech against Muslims. And so those are issues that have been heavily criticised.
Were you conscious of that? I mean, did you feel that when you were there?
Absolutely. And Muslim people especially, but even Christians, Sikhs, lots of people of other religions. And we should note, India is a hugely diverse country. It has 170 million Muslim people. It's huge how big that population is. But every time I would ask Australian ministers, the Prime Minister came a few times to India, that question was fobbed off about issues around democracy or criticism around the treatment of minorities. This is an issue that the Australian government doesn't acknowledge publicly and doesn't want to talk about, which I think is interesting because it's more in its national interest to keep this relationship going and keep it strong.
The podcast is called Looking for Modi. Avani, great to have you back.
Thank you.
Well, very interesting to hear that story from Avani herself, Jerry.
Yes, it's getting all sorts of international attention, that story, and it segues very nicely with our chat with Ravi Agrawal. He's the editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine that did a complete edition recently on India, the coming superpower, I think they suggested it might be. He's host of its video channel and podcast, FP Live. Here he is now.
Ravi Agrawal, welcome to Global Roaming.
Great to be on.
Surprise us. Who's going to win this thing?
Well, it's a fool's errand to try and predict elections in India and anywhere, I guess. But polls are strongly suggesting that Narendra Modi will win a third term and his party, the Bharatiya Janata Party or the BJP, will return to power. It's hard to believe that any other outcome will happen, but of course, anything's possible.
I wanted to ask you how radically Modi's actually reshaped the whole political landscape in India during his time in office. Because when you think back to those days when the Congress was strong, the Gandhi dynasty was strong, that just seems like such a distant memory now.
It really does. And so on the one hand, you have Modi and his party that are very popular. But if you exclude a few times that the Congress was dominant, in recent history, India has mostly had coalition governments. And your listeners will be very familiar with how parliamentary democracies work. But, you know, times 10 in India, because there are so many political parties that before 2014, it was extremely unlikely that any one party could win a majority of seats in parliament. With Modi, that's begun to change. So in 2014, he won about 31% of the national vote. And then in 2019, he won 38% of the vote, which meant that the BJP on its own had an absolute majority in parliament, which has allowed them to pursue their agenda much more confidently. And polls suggest that this time round, Modi could win even more seats, so much more than an absolute majority, and enough seats to really not need anyone's support for any of the measures that his government wants to push through.
And Ravi, can you help us understand, please, the nature of the mood behind all that? Because there really are quite extraordinary stories emerging from Indians whom a lot of us have followed over the years, good writers, about the appalling levels of hate speech that are underway, the sort of unprecedented allegiances seeming to be developed between people in the media that was regarded as a pretty open media, and this message of much more of a Hindu superiority. And even institutions, really venerable institutions like the Indian Supreme Court, people aren't sure they can judge that the sort of, objective rule of law is being applied. Like, do you see it like this?
I do. I mean, so India, you know, has elections. It is technically democratic in the sense that it has free and fair elections, but many of the pillars of democracy have been eroded. So you mentioned the judiciary, which has been weakened over the last decade or so in Modi's time in power. The press has weakened tremendously. It is much harder to be a journalist in India today than it was in years past. And so really, there's a lot of feeling nationally of, you know, real news about the government's performance not being aired out in the way that it should.
But now, maybe that is because, Ravi, as people have suggested, the parts of the media and really agree. It's not as if they're being dragged to it. They really agree with the BJP agenda.
So you're getting to the nub of it here. Part of the BJP's agenda is welfarism, which we can get into on the economics, but on the social agenda, this is where it gets tricky. A big part of the BJP's social agenda is to appeal to Hindus, and Hindus comprise about 80% of the country's population. And the BJP's bet has long been that if they can play Hindus against other groups, Muslims, Christians, other minorities, if they can consolidate the Hindu vote, then they can be assured of victory. And he's mobilized this group, Hindus, of which there are more than a billion. He's mobilized them by appealing to their sense of pride, by appealing to Hindu culture, by the supremacy of the religion, which is in some senses codified in law in many ways, by sort of reducing the salience of secularism, and by telling Hindus that in some senses, his rule is a return to a glorious past of Hindus, and that if anyone but him were in power, then that could be imperiled. For example, he's been making very incendiary speeches in the last couple of weeks in which he's claiming that the opposition, the Congress primarily, were they to come to power, they would disproportionately aid and support Muslims. And, you know, by using that kind of rhetoric against Muslims, Modi's attempting to mobilize the Hindu vote to sort of awaken this sense of Hindus being discriminated against historically. At least that's what the narrative that he's trying to put forward. And this is, as you were alluding to, increasingly popular nationally. And it's a form of nationalism that once it takes off, it's very hard to sort of bottle it back in.
But Ravi, obviously that sort of ideology is not new. It's been around for at least 100 years in India. But today there's something like 172 million Muslims. There's 28 million Christians, 20 million Sikhs. How dangerous is this pathway in your mind for India?
It's dangerous. I think it's dangerous, especially for Muslims as the largest minority group. Their rights are being corroded. They're being made to feel like the internal other that must be turned upon. None of this is good for their well-being, their sense of security and being a part of the state and being citizens. It's also something that ends up harming secularism, which is enshrined in the Indian constitution. And in many ways, if you look back to the founding ideals of India, India is such an unlikely union. It's an unlikely democracy. You know, it's this mishmash motley of different states and languages and cultures and cuisines and religions. And the thing that knitted it all together when India became independent in 1947 was this idea that for it to survive, it needed to be secular and it needed to be democratic. And the BJP just has a different idea of India. Its idea of India is that of a Hindu first, even Hindi first, the language version of the country.
And don't they also, there seems to be, like if you think of Nehru, and when Nehru and Gandhi and the whole old Congress party, there was a very much broader sense of how we'll define ourselves as Indian. Now, if you're right, and others are saying exactly the same thing, and particularly with young Indians, that they want this stronger perceived identity. Is that it? And in fact, I've read that they actually think a lot of that whole non-violent stuff, as they call it, from Nehru and so on, made them soft. And in fact, the BJP almost praises that assassination of Gandhi. I mean, this is quite extraordinary, I think, for Australians to grasp.
It is. And it could be that India is changing in ways that we're seeing in front of our own eyes. You know, it's easy and popular, I think, to, in analyses of Modi and his party, to see all of the changes that they're bringing to the country as top down, to see, in other words, the changes as purely a supply side issue. And what I've been writing recently in my magazine, Foreign Policy, is that all of us must begin to also see these changes as a demand side equation, in that it could be that this is what a majority of Indians want, that they want a vision of the country that is more assertive of its Hindu past, that is more assertive of this idea and vision of a Hindu nation that is rising up, that is more confident, that has found its voice and its place in the world. And again, it's a form of Hindu revivalism. It's a form of nationalism that is quite popular, especially among younger Indians who look around the world and they look around their neighbors. They look at Singapore, they look at China, and they begin to ask questions. Well, why aren't we like them? Why aren't we stronger? Why aren't we more proud about our identity and our civilization? When will Hindus rise up? Muslims have their own countries. Christians have their own countries. Jews have a country. Why shouldn't Hindus have a country that is their own? And this kind of discourse is increasingly popular in India.
So when Indians look at those other countries that you just listed off, are they also seeing something economic that they are aspiring to? I mean, India is so long, perennially, in fact, underperformed economically and development-wise. Are they looking at those other nations and saying, actually, we deserve that too?
Well, in China's case, certainly. I think for generations now, India has looked at China with some degree of envy, not only because they have, you know, essentially a strongman authoritarian as a leader who can get things done, but also their rate of growth. And I think this is where it's a bit of a mixed picture in India, and it depends on how you interpret it. I mentioned welfareism at the start. You know, Modi has embarked on a huge national program of state building. Under Modi, you know, more than 6,000 miles of highways are being built every year. India has twice as many airports than it did a decade ago. Domestic passengers have doubled in quantity to about 200 million. The middle classes are spending a lot more money per capita. Consumption expenditure in urban areas is up by more than 100%. And so younger Indians especially, they look at all of these things and they say, well, you know, we're doing better. Look around you. There's more infrastructure. India's finally pulling its weight. But the reason why I said it's a mixed picture is that a lot of economists will point out that this growth isn't even. India, on the one hand, has a lot more billionaires, but it also has a lot of poor people who haven't sort of been pulled out of poverty. Crucially, youth unemployment is really high. 83% of all unemployed people in India are young. The youth unemployment in India is upwards of 15% by some measures. And so it's not as if this government can say that it has, you know, run a perfect economy. It has made mistakes. It's had some real missteps. And again, this is why these elections are important, because, you know, how long can people purely vote on the basis of nationalism, on the basis of pride? At the end of the day, every election globally, it ends up being about pocketbook issues at some level. And so we're looking closely at this election to see if Indians feel that their lives have actually improved, or if they feel that a lot of what they're being told about the state of the economy is marketing. And Modi and the BJP are exceptional at marketing themselves.
That's true. Those incredible performances he put on at Madison Square Garden and here in Australia. I mean, just remarkable branding exercise for a leader, but also for a country. You know, Ravi, that the US, Australia are really betting a lot on India in their attempts to sort of balance China geopolitically. Obviously, India being part of the Quad is significant. But there are big differences. India's, you know, from the non-aligned movement. It's but has maintained a sort of fairly transactional relationship with Russia, even during the Ukraine conflict. What are countries like Australia getting when they're buddying up to Modi's India?
And can I just, I mean, this is where your little bits of stats are worth it. Second largest armed forces in the world, I now read, and the fastest growing military capability in the world. So this is all a backdrop, isn't it?
And the world's longest disputed border.
Precisely.
With China.
So India is going to do what is in its best interests. India, as you pointed out, was you know, one of the founding members of the non-aligned movement in the 50s and 60s. It is still non-aligned in some senses, but it likes to call it strategic autonomy. So no matter who India cozies up to, it is going to act in its own self-interest in a sort of a la carte kind of pick your friends in the moment way. And this is immensely popular. I think most Indians feel that their government is doing a good job on foreign policy. So for example, with Russia, India has this old alliance going back to the days of the Soviet Union. But beyond that alliance, India needs cheap oil. So when Russia invaded Ukraine and much of the West sanctioned Russia, that oil, A, had to go somewhere, and B, it found a very willing buyer in India. So before the invasion of Ukraine, only 1% of Russian crude found its way to India. Today, it's upwards of 50%. So India is buying cheap Russian oil, which it needs. By the way, this also means that oil prices are low globally, because if India didn't buy it, it would have to buy it somewhere else. That would lead to prices being higher. And America is very aware of this. So America isn't trying to stop India from buying cheap Russian oil. There's a sense of complicity all around. I think America is under no illusions that if it went to war with China over Taiwan, New Delhi is not going to come to its aid. That said, America's worst nightmare is that India cozies up to China. So the Quad, it just makes sense for it to go on as it does, because the alternative, India being friendly to China, is far worse. And that's kind of how India is playing it. They're trying to get the best out of this global system in every single instance on a case-by-case basis, and they're going to keep doing that. So even with Australia, for example, Australia could buddy up with India. India's still going to do what makes the most sense for its strategic interests. It doesn't believe in morals, in a sense. It doesn't believe in an ideological vision of how it should act on the global stage. It's purely transactional.
But that'll only go so far, won't it? And if the internal Indian story becomes more complicated, I just wonder whether this is really going to be a useful strategy. You know, I mean, Erdogan in Turkey tries this. He doesn't do it very well at all. There needs to be some consistency, doesn't there, in the way a country presents itself, or don't you agree?
I mean, that's a great question. Erdogan will say that it's working for him and that he gets to extract promises from NATO, from Europe, from the United States, purely by playing spoiler when it suits his purposes. So one interpretation could be that it is actually working for Turkey. They might be losing soft power, but they're gaining strategic advantages. I think India feels like it doesn't care about soft power as much right now, that it's in fact had soft power for generations. What it was missing was hard power. And so it's trying to extract strategic advantages for itself, again, on a case-by-case basis. Whether this works in the longer term, I think, is something we'll have to wait and watch to see how that plays out. But again, I think crucially for this government, at least, it is popular.
Ravi, various people that I've spoken to about Modi that have met him, even his biographer, say he's almost unknowable, that there is this kind of mystery and almost deliberate mythology. You have met him. You've made interviews for CNN happen with him, spent some time, I think, before and after with Modi. Any observations? Can you see beyond the myth?
Well, I mean, there are a few things that all of us can see. He is a masterful orator in Hindi. He's widely perceived as hardworking, as committed to the country's success. I think corruption is a very important thing in terms of how Indians see him. So the previous government, the Congress party, was widely seen as corrupt. It was also seen as dynastic. And Modi doesn't have children. He doesn't have a partner. And that in and of itself is seen as a reason why he would not be corrupt, because he wouldn't have wealth to hand down to the next generation. Now, all of that is part of his mystique, this mystique of someone who grew up very poor, lower caste, lower middle class, and was able to make it. It's a popular story because it sort of speaks to average Indians who feel like if he could make it, then so can we. And Modi's been very good, again, at marketing that story. I think one thing that people outside of India may not recognize as well is that it's hard for me to think of another world leader who is as good as marketing their successes. For example, when
like
India
with
hosted
the G20.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I mean, hosting the G20 is the most perfunctory thing in the world. A different country hosts it every year. It should be no big deal. But when India hosts it, oh my gosh, there are billboards plastered all over the country with one man's face, Modi. And so it's all about him. He has been very successful at making everything all about him. If people get gas connections, if they get direct transfers of food or money, they are told, here's the person you need to thank. It's all about Modi. Now, the flip side of this, of course, is that if anything goes wrong, then Modi owns that as well. And so when eventually something goes wrong, he will have to face the consequences.
Just on the bigger picture, Ravi, before we go, obviously, all of the world's focus is really on China as the emerging superpower in the region. Could India, in fact, overtake China?
I think India is a long, long ways from overtaking China on the economy. I mean, to put this in perspective, the average Indian makes about $2,500 a year. The average Chinese makes about $12,000 a year. So, in that sense, India is about four or five times smaller than China in terms of average income, even though it now has a bigger population. Even at its growth rate, which is running at around about 7% faster than China, it would take decades for India to overtake China on that front. There are other hurdles. As economies become bigger, their growth tends to slow down. India has all kinds of problems with its demographics. I pointed to the youth unemployment rate. Foreign direct investment, for example, has actually declined in the last 3 or 4 years. Even domestic investment is down in the last few years because a lot of Indian businesses feel that Modi is more likely to turn to cronies, some rich billionaires in India, to enact his industrial policy projects. So there is fear in India, and fear is never healthy when you're trying to open up markets, when you're trying to turbocharge growth. So India has a lot of hurdles. It is going to grow. It is going to become a rising, growing force globally. But I think India is flattered to deceive many times in the last 20 or 30 years. And I think we have to watch it very carefully to know that it's really going to be a bigger contender. I don't see it overtaking China in our generation.
Ravi Agrawal, thank you very much indeed. That's been a fabulous conversation.
Real pleasure.
Well, that was a very bracing conversation, I thought, Hamish. I must say, for me, hearing all that talk about hate speech took me back, I have to say, this will sound dramatic, to my visit to Rwanda a few years back and knowing and seeing the evidence that years of unrestrained hate speech from the Hutus about the Tutsis resulted in the most appalling carnage. Now, I'm not suggesting that's exactly analogous, but, you know, it's very bad when you allow hate speech unrestrained to go into populations that are finely balanced. Mm. Very bad things can result.
And I think it is worth remembering, we're not talking about small minorities that are being sort of set aside here. The Muslim population getting up towards 200 million people, significant numbers of millions of people that are Sikh, that are Christian and other faiths in India. Really interesting observations, I think, from Ravi about the push-pull, you know, the supply and demand in Indian politics today. But you do have to question how much of that is the demand of the population when the opposition's been so eroded over time, the Congress really sort of offering no viable alternative, the reduction in freedom of the press, you know, clearly lots of examples there. We heard from Avani as well about the impacts on just free and fair and open reporting in India. You mentioned the damage to institutions as well. So what is it that's going on in India that's sort of shaping this moment? I think that's worth thinking about.
I think that's exactly right. And I just think we probably haven't grasped it. So, you know, people have been telling us in all sorts of various interviews, and when Modi came, of course, it was like a rock star. Our Prime Minister said it's like Bruce Springsteen on stage, and then the next moment is Modi. So, look, he's remarkable, but I really think it bears very close attention.
Recommendations for this week, I would suggest that you take a listen to Avani Dias's terrific podcast series, Looking for Modi, one of the factors that she was given for the Indian government, perhaps not looking on her visa application with fondness.
Hear, hear. And I might suggest the Ezra Klein Show from December. They had a very interesting interview with Pratap Bhanu Mehta from Princeton University, who's a big commentator for Indian Express. And that gives more depth and background, and I found it very helpful.
Links to those things in the notes of this episode's page. You can email us, global.roaming@abc.net.au. Please do keep in touch. We love getting the feedback, and we'd love to meet you as well. Well, if you're in Sydney for the Sydney Writers' Festival, the 25th of May, we'll be discussing the topic of Australia's twin perils.
As always, our thanks to Taryn Priyadko, our producer, with whom we wouldn't be here. So lovely to have your company. Bye-bye, Hamish.
See you, Jerry.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.